Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Paytm. Paytm is the best way to pay your bills because you can pay all of your bills at once in one place, and you'll get $10 back when you pay your bills. Pay a $200 bill, get $10 back when you download the Paytm Canada app and use the promo code CanadaLand. And guys, I am on vacation this week. Filling in for me is the terrific Omar Mualem. Enjoy.
This episode of Canada Land is being recorded in Edmonton. I'm your guest host, Omar Mualem. The first thing Mac Lamoureux ever said to me was, "I hear you're a Holocaust denier." Now, I am not, but when he said it at a brunch, my stomach turned because I knew exactly why he was asking. See, in 2014, I criticized men's rights activists in a newspaper column, and they retaliated by creating a YouTube video claiming that I was a Holocaust denier in the headline. It taught me that there's a personal cost to covering belligerent fringe groups like MRAs, and at the same time, why even give these people column inches when they lie so brazenly? So I made a note not to cover them again, and I hope that I wouldn't have to explain myself as totally, absolutely, 100% not a Holocaust denier to anyone I know. Unfortunately, I met Mac, and he wants to talk about it on the record for a school paper about MRAs and their slanderous tactics. Mac was a student at McEwen University here in Edmonton who had left the oil sands to try to start a second career in journalism, and my first impression of him told me that he had an interest in people on the fringes. Now, fast forward 3 years, and Mac is Vice's de facto beat reporter on conspiracy theories and extremist right-wing groups in Canada, or as he calls himself, a historian on weird internet thingies. But here's the thing. Those internet thingies aren't so weird anymore. Kooky ideas like Pizzagate have entered the mainstream, and the term weird doesn't exactly capture how dangerous some of them have become. Sure, his early work started innocently enough with stories on a subculture of men using magic spells to get laid, and a nutty conspiracy theory about how the Berenstain Bears, prove that we live in a parallel universe or something. But this year, Mac exposed an Alberta group calling itself the 3%, an anti-Muslim group built on conspiracies like the belief that ISIS is sending trainees into Canada across U.S. borders. And it's a group that is also doing paramilitary-style training, monitoring mosques, and discussing plans to build flash bombs. The 8-month investigation titled The Birth of Canada's Armed Anti-Islamic Patriot Group was one of the more underappreciated investigations this year because it showed both how extremist groups were mobilizing on Facebook in the open and how ignoring fringe groups, as I swore to myself that I'd do, might do more harm than good. And his beat has come with a cost. Mac has suffered misinformation campaigns against him, calling him a pedophile, amongst other things, and he's been doxxed too. We're going to talk about that, why he thinks it's time to take fringe groups seriously, and the delicate art of accessing and sometimes infiltrating them. Mac Lamoureux joins me in a minute.
Jesse here again, just doing some housekeeping. This episode is brought to you by Laurie McCauley, Brian Mayer, Adam Weltzhofer, Robert Fajber, Sarah Fellin, Marty Levesque, Michael Mooney, and Alex Eddington.
Hey, I'm Alex. I'm a composer and theater artist in Toronto. I support Canada Land because independent media should be fierce, funny, and free, and hold people's feet to the fire. And it should be able to say F-words freely.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world. And it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing. And it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is also brought to you by Paytm. Paytm is kind of new to Canada, but the technology is made in Canada. They make this stuff here. It is incredibly popular in India. Everybody uses it. They know what you now know, which is that moving money around should be effortless. There's no reason for there to be fees or any kind of hassle involved in moving money around. That is the grand vision of Paytm. They are introducing themselves to Canadians first and foremost as a bill payment solution. That makes a lot of sense. Why should you have to go and pay your bills through various different methods? Why should you be getting bills in the mail and then having to mail things back or go to the bank? Do it all through an app that lets you track everything and do it all in minutes and get money back when you do. Paytm wants to give you $10. Pay a $200 bill, get $10 back. When you download the Paytm Canada app in Apple's App Store or Google Play and use the promo code, not the referral code, mind you, but the promo code, Canada Land. And this episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. Are you a freelancer? Are you a small business owner? I feel your pain. I know what you're going through because tax season is here. And if you have not been using FreshBooks, then the chore is a much bigger headache. Because if you've been using FreshBooks, it's keeping track of everything for you. It knows how much HST is coming out, going in. It knows all about your expenses. It knows all, and it can spit out a report at the click of a button. You can use it to put together your own income tax filing or to send it off to your accountant, and you don't have to sort through a shoebox full of receipts or go through old records. It makes life during tax season so much easier. It's sort of this big time savings you get once a year, in addition to all of the many smaller time savings you get throughout the year when you put together your invoices and all of your expenses way quicker than if you were drafting that from scratch. Also good for estimates and time tracking, stuff like that. And it gets you paid quicker. FreshBooks is a great tool. I think it is the industry standard tool for small businesses and freelancers. Millions of people around the world use this Canadian-made tool for their cloud accounting. Check it out. Try it out. 30 days. You don't need a credit card. When you do decide to become a customer, tell them that Canada Land sent you. And you will be doing the show a favor. Go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand. Okay, enough of me. Here's Omar.
Mac, thanks for joining us on Canada Land.
Thanks for having me. Nice to see you again, Omar.
I'm going to take you back about a decade. You're working up north. You're working as an instrumentationist.
Well, I've done several jobs in the oil field. Uh-huh. So I was an instrumentation technician. I was blue booked at Nate actually for that. I did chemical cleaning, which with acid, which sucked. And then I operated. Yeah, it was terrible. And then I operated locomotives at a liquid propane gas.
Okay, so while you're doing that, mm-hmm. you're passing the time. You're listening to talk radio, and you come across a show called Coast to Coast with Art Bell and later George Noory. He's talking with listeners and experts about yeah. Bigfoot and how humans never walked on the moon. What did that teach you about the kinds of people who believe in these theories?
Well, it kind of teaches you a little bit of the fact that they are willing to believe anything. My favorite story has to do with, I think it was Art Bell. It was back when I was working 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. shifts out at Provident Williams near Redwater. And he just came on and he was like, look, we don't know if we've confirmed this, but somebody sent us a tape and we believe it's from hell. Well, let me play you this. And it was just a bunch of screaming. He's like, we don't know if this for sure is from hell, but it might be. And that kind of encapsulates it a little bit there, where these people are kind of willing to believe anything. There, once you kind of break into a certain threshold of believing in conspiracies, when you believe anything can be real, it A, becomes magical, and B, it becomes dangerous.
I absolutely heard the hell tape.
Yeah,
and
wonderful.
I did believe in it a little bit. I was 15 years old. but is there a difference between the conspiracy theories that Art Bell was peddling and the conspiracy theories that you write about now?
To me, it definitely feels like there is, definitely with the proliferation of like the internet and the mainstreaming of people like Alex Jones and Mike Cernovich and everything. But again, I was younger back when I was listening to Art Bell and everything, and you can't really overstate the people like Timothy McVeigh, who was a New World Order guy. But yeah, definitely it seems that it's taken a turn, and you see these conspiracies very prevalent in the militia movement. You see them very prevalent in the right-wing extremist movement. You even see them prevalent in a few far-left movements that are against Zionism, that are against
Vaccinations
that are against things like that. So definitely, I believe the internet has, to a point, a little bit melted our brains, and we've seen these conspiracies get far larger than they ever would in the past, where they were much more of a fringe thing.
Well, I'm going to list a few of the things that you've covered at mm-hmm. Vice, and you just give me a quick one-sentence explanation of what they are, okay?
Oh, God, okay.
Okay, hollow Earth theory.
The Earth is hollow, and inside there are Vikings and Nazis.
Men going their own way.
Men who believe that feminism is a cancer, and the best way to fight that is self-imposed chastity.
Straight men.
Straight men.
Yeah. Iraq Stargate.
There is a Stargate in Iraq, and that's why we invaded it.
Sherry Schreiner.
Oh, one sentence?
Maybe the most interesting thing about that.
Yeah, the most interesting thing about that is, well, it's kind of, so the Sherry Schreiner thing, she's a woman that is very prolific on YouTube, and she's also very, very quick to get the lawyers on the case of people, so I'm going to be very careful of what I say here. She's kind of one of the reptilian ladies, reptiles rule the world, you know, David Icke, those kind of people.
Sure, yes.
And so essentially what happened is there was a fallout between one of her followers and the rest of her followers, and he asked his girlfriend to kill him, and she did.
And
she
did
shot
it.
Him in the head. And this was back in, I believe, April.
That's interesting, because it just shows that with the internet, cults don't necessarily have to exist in the same place. They don't have to be regional anymore. They can exist in the ether. You can have followers without actually having to have face-to-face contact with them. I have one more for mm-hmm. you. The Berenstain Bears. What's that all about?
Oh, God. I'm never going to get rid of this story. So essentially, the Berenstain Bears story is that we all grew up with the Berenstain Bears, and we all grew up thinking it was STEIN. And it's actually STAIN. And what some people believe, this is the cause of something they call the Mandela effect, which is that there was a little bit of a ripple in the space-time continuum. Think the Matrix. And that we're in a different parallel universe than the one we grew up in.
The books were literally rewritten, but only with like a couple letters.
Yeah, with just like, well, that's it's not that they were rewritten. That's the glitch in the Matrix.
So that was your most popular story ever. It was the second most popular story on Vice Canada in 2015.
I believe so.
How do you come across these conspiracy theories? Because they are even wilder, I think, than the ones that I remember mm-hmm. hearing as a teenager, Bigfoot and the Moonland yeah. hoaxes. What sites and back channels are you monitoring? And like, what is the overlap that these conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists have with fringe right-wing groups?
Ooh, that's a heck of a question there. So essentially, I am somebody you could describe as being extremely online. I find a lot of these through, say, weird Reddit channels. I find a lot of them through really weird Facebook groups. It's gotten to the point now that if somebody sees a really weird conspiracy, like the one I wrote about the guy who accidentally convinced the internet that Finland didn't exist, that was just somebody sending that to me. And I was like, oh my God, is this real? And I contacted the guy and he was like, yeah,
so
my parents are very
yourself.
Mad at me.
But when you what Facebook groups, what Reddit channels, where do we find these communities?
You can find a lot of them on secret Facebook groups. There's Reddit conspiracy. There's an entire Reddit page for conspiracies. You can find a lot of them being brewed on several 4chan pages, maybe not so much Poll. B has a lot of them. You can find them just on lots of corners of the webs. Every person has a blog now. If you Google the right things, you can come up with the blogs. But when you bring in the Venn diagram between these right-wing and these far-right-wing groups and these conspiracy theorists, is that it's almost primarily on Facebook. And what you find is you find that people are sharing it through, I guess for lack of a better term, memes, very shareable content. Their YouTube videos that are being shared on Facebook, that would be their main form of communication. When you get a little bit more serious, you will get Discord channels, you will get Signal chats, you will get these people taking it offline. But when you talk about like their base of recruitment and their base of everything, it's almost primarily on Facebook.
It seems to me like the overlap is a inherent distrust of authority and what we would call, you know, mainstream media or just mainstream information.
Yeah, 100%. I would agree with that for sure. Essentially, like it feels that I think I said earlier that the internet's melted our brain and we are just slammed with all this information. And there is a lot of people who aren't journalists, that aren't like us, who don't have the time to flush out what's a reliable source, what's not a reliable source. There's people that just, they work a full day. Their uncle sends them something, their brother sends them something, their coworker sends them something. You trust that person. You think that's going to be true. You think that, I think a good one that just recently happened is, do you think Justin Trudeau just said that ISIS fighters are going to be great additions to the Canadian ecosystem? But that's not true. What he essentially said is that reintegrated ISIS fighters, people that we have de-radicalized, can help with the process of de-radicalizing other.
So this gets distorted.
Yes.
It becomes a meme and then it becomes a conspiracy.
And then it becomes a conspiracy.
You know, it's interesting to think back to the conspiracy theories peddled even by Alex Jones and InfoWars 10 years ago. And, you know, the two that come to my mind, you mentioned earlier anti-vaxxer misinformation, but also that 9/11 was a
inside job,
the trutherism. Yep. These were both far left conspiracies.
Yeah.
Now popular conspiracy theories seem to be more on the political far right.
Yeah.
Did the pendulum swing, or is it just that we in the media who do have an interest in this, that we just don't cover the far left conspiracies anymore?
Yeah, I don't want to say that anti-vaxxers or anything aren't the problems, but definitely the pendulum does swing, and it does swing with political power. In 2008, you saw a giant resurgence of militias. You saw a giant resurgence of patriots groups. You saw a giant resurgence of this kind of conspiracy theory for money. And it's the first time you're able to see people make some serious cash off it. InfoWars blowing up. People like Mike Cernovich coming up, even though he was more of the 2016 Trump election when he came. It's the same thing you saw kind of in Canada with Justin Trudeau being elected was the best thing that ever happened to these far right groups. This is when you saw the burgeoning of a lot of the far right groups like the Soldiers of Odin. That's when you saw kind of the birth of the Three Percenters. It's when you saw a lot of these groups that believe that somebody who is going to inherently harm Canada, like Justin Trudeau, and then you include these memes, these distortion of truth and everything. And you can say what you want about Justin Trudeau, but you have to agree that there are a lot of misinformation regarding his policies and what he states he's going to do. And when you mix those two things, you can get a little bit of a dangerous cocktail of mixing xenophobia and firepower.
You've mentioned some pretty serious examples of conspiracies run amok, being sort of co-opted by militias that have maybe some dangerous intent or intent of a violent revolution, at least in the United States, though we'll talk later about the Canadian implications
of
that. But we've also talked about some of the more innocuous things, like, you know, I'm not losing sleep over the Berenstein Bears and the Berenstein Bears. So how do you decide when a crazy idea like the Berenstein Bears or a fringe group like the Soldiers of Odin is worth investigating?
Well, those are definitely two separate thought process with the crazy ideas. If I think it's funny, if I think there's enough people who believe it, I'll end up covering that conspiracy theory. But when it comes to far right groups, there's a completely different thought process that goes behind it, because you can bolster their recruitment, you can bolster their profile. And it's definitely something we need to think about. And it's definitely something that I think about. And I've done a little bit of soul searching in regards to it, especially after Charlottesville, the death of Heather Heyer out there when she was run over by a far right extremist during the protest. So essentially, when I'm trying to figure out if I want to cover a fringe group, I want to see what the narrative is about this fringe group. If the narrative is incorrect, I would like to write something to correct the narrative. As in, what happened a lot with the Soldiers of Odin is there would be a lot of very uncritical news stories in regards to the Soldiers of Odin are, say, shoveling people's driveways. Soldiers of Odin are cleaning up parks.
Can you remind us, who are the Soldiers of Odin? They are an anti-immigration, yeah, anti-Muslim, yeah, group.
So essentially, the Soldiers of Odin was started in 2015 by a man named Mika Ranta, who is a white supremacist in Finland. He has actually gone to jail, I believe, for assaulting a refugee who had just come over. So what Mika Ranta did is he created the Soldiers of Odin, a group that will walk the streets. It's a little bit of a community watch program.
And we have chapters in Canada. Actually, one of the biggest chapters is here in Edmonton. In your reporting, has one of those fun-seeming stories like the Berenstain Bears, has that evolved into the other type of dangerous extremist conspiracies at all?
Not yet. I'm sure probably down the road it will, but we live in dumb times.
I mean, some of the stuff that you report on is obviously, you mentioned the word fun like five times there, and funny. Like it's just fun to gawk at this.
They're usually great people too. They're more than willing to talk to you about, say, the Hollow Earth. They know I'm going to kind of make fun of them, but I try and be respectful to them.
So are you trying also then to humanize them, or oppositely, is it just about gawking at them? I mean, you know, I have to assume that you had brushed up with some of the people who do believe in conspiracies when you were working that job listening to Coast to Coast. I have to imagine some of the people that were listening with
were
super into it.
Yeah.
So what is your intent with doing these stories?
I think a good story always humanizes its subject. I know it can be dangerous to do so when it comes to certain people. But the way I finished my Hollow Earth story was essentially being like, remember when these conspiracies were a little harmless and everything like that? And the people were wonderful. They're prolific writers. They write all these books that all their fans buy. And they're not really a danger to anybody. So I do try and humanize them. And I, in all aspects of my reporting, I guess a level of humanization comes into it. And it has gotten me a little bit of hell from several people, both on the left and the right.
The goal of these fringe groups on either side of the spectrum is to push their agenda into the Overton window.
Yes.
Basically, the things that we find acceptable for public discussion. Mm-hmm. And we see already terms like the red pill and deep state and globalist entering the lexicon of mainstream Canadian and American politicians.
Yeah.
Donald Trump endorses tweets from the lead Pizzagaters and appears on InfoWars. What do you think this tells us about the times that we are living in?
They're weird times. I think that might be a good way of putting it. I've never experienced anything like this. It feels they are so powerful, and it feels very hard at some times to fight back against the disenfranchisement of mainstream media and trying to get actual facts out there when you are just painted as fake news. And I'm not saying that's among the main populace. I'm saying that's among these kind of community groups, these kind of ecosystems that I tend to spend time in. Within a certain population, these people are winning, and make no assurance of the opposite. These people are very powerful, and what they say holds a lot of weight with a lot of people. And that's why you're seeing endorsements of, you know, I believe it wasn't the English Defense League, but it was, I think,
Britain
First, at the very least, a virulent anti-Islamic group.
We're talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Endorsing three tweets by Britain First, which even in Britain is seen as a dangerous and extremist group by most British people.
So essentially, he retweeted three videos of what was purported to be Muslim people attacking white people within Europe.
It included one that was a supposed Muslim refugee attacking a Dutch boy on crutches. Yeah. Completely false.
Well, that actually reminds me, very readily of a story in Red Deer in Alberta here, where there was a video of, you know, just a schoolyard fight, and I believe it was Pegida Canada, and it was WCIA, which is the World Coalition Against Islam, which are two very large groups, anti-Islamic groups within Canada. They purported it to be that it was Syrian refugee children that were beating up white kids. And there was a rally against children in Red Deer. People came there to protest refugee children over what is 100% fake news. And you had people, I don't know if the rebel...
How did the media handle it?
The media handled it relatively well. The media that you would think of, Global, handled it well. CBC ran a debunking piece that was very good. Paula Simons, who pound for pound, I honestly believe is the best columnist in Canada, ran a very good piece about it. But then you have groups like the Rebel, you have other groups that were running with it. And you've seen them run with anti-refugee children things time and time again. And I don't know what it is about that particular sore spot within a portion of Canadians' population, but God, does it ever agitate some people.
Well, it's interesting that the mainstream media does even have to follow up on mm-hmm. these things and put work into convincing people that false information is false. Because, I mean, it used to be that fringe groups and fringe ideas were covered only on trash television. Mm-hmm. Like Jerry Springer would have the KKK on his show. Now with the rise of Pegida, Richard Spencer, the Proud Boys, etc., do we have to start taking these groups seriously? Or might we be giving a small group like the Soldiers of Odin or the Three Percenters too much attention? Because maybe they would just fizzle out if we ignored them. And I think back to how MRAs in Canada exploited media's magnetic pull towards sensational and outrageous mm-hmm. things. They made themselves famous off of stunts like postering Edmonton with misogynist and anti-feminist propaganda. I wonder if they never got the headlines in the first place, if they wouldn't be as significant or important as they are today.
I think that's a very fair point. And as I said earlier, I grapple with it sometimes. As I was saying earlier, if I believe the narrative is incorrect, if I believe people are painting these groups to be something they're not, and I can prove that false, I will write that story. If I believe this is a group that the Canadian population needs to know about, I will write that story. But if this is a group that has no influence over other people, if this is a group with one or two members, if this is like that Peterborough rally that happened in November where it was one neo-Nazi standing in the city center, well, you know what? I don't know if we necessarily need to run mm-hmm. that story. But when it's people like the Three Percenters, which is probably the one I got the most slack for because no one had ever really heard of them before, you have a group that is openly admitting to doing paramilitary-style training, to stockpiling weapons, to buying land. I believe that's something that the Canadian population needs to know about. I also know that my story bolstered their membership a bit. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact it did. It's a hard thing to grapple with, but we just need to get better at it.
Interesting. So you may have put them on the radar of activists mm-hmm. or the concerned citizen, but you also helped the thing that's probably most important to them, which is their membership. Is there any group that you regret covering? Have you ever gotten the calculation about what to cover wrong?
Certainly. I certainly have. No one's perfect. I believe I made the Soldiers of Odin out to be a little too strong, a little stronger than they really were. As we're seeing now, they are essentially crumbling.
Yes, extremely fractured. Yeah. And
yeah. So I believe I made them out to be a little bit too strong.
Least you didn't do what CBC Saskatoon and Saskatchewan did, which was make them out to be an innocuous group that just shovels the sidewalks of seniors in the winter.
Yeah, that is not good. I get it. I'm a former local reporter at CBC Edmonton. I cut some of my teeth there, and it was great. But you are writing 5 stories a day. Sometimes you don't have the ability nor the time to flush out what these groups are. And that's when it's important that people who do beat coverage of this come in and correct it a bit.
And you follow them to do your deep dives, you follow them for quite some time. Like you have a, dare I say, encyclopedic knowledge of white supremacy iconography and history. I know that you've been following the evolution of the movement on websites like Stormfront. I assume there are others as well. Why do you put so much time into this?
I believe it's very important. There's also a little bit of the fact that I feel that because of my blue-collar roots and the fact that I come from a pretty far-right place in Canada, which is a small community in central North Alberta. There's people in northern Alberta that are going to get mad at me if I say Fort Saskatchewan.
Say it proud. Fort Saskatchewan.
Yeah, Fort Saskatchewan, Alberta. but I believe that, like, I'm able to get into these groups. I'm able to speak their language. I understand them. Dare I say I have a little bit of empathy, not sympathy for them, due to the fact that I am a lot more angry at the people who are peddling them this false information than I am for people not having the time to suff it out. But it's a very interesting. It's a very interesting thing that we're seeing happen between the nexus of technology and communication right now. I believe it's massive. We're seeing it across the world. We're seeing Generation Identity in Europe. We're seeing Richard Spencer. You're seeing all these groups in the United States. And now we're starting to see it in Canada. And especially when we're speaking about the 3%ers, who, as we mentioned earlier, are a militia style group. But the very interesting thing about them is that they're a very Americanized militia group. One of the experts I spoke to, Ryan Scrivens, who is a PhD candidate and is one of our country's few experts in far-right extremism, called them a wholesale lift of an American militia within Canada, which is very interesting. So we are starting to see this little bit of the power of the American culture, not just with television and not just with media, but we're starting to see it with these internet memes, with these conspiracies come over to Canada. And they call themselves the 3%ers, and the 3%ers essentially comes from an American myth that it was 3% of the population that fought against the British in the War of Independence. So to call yourself 3% Alberta is asinine. But we're just seeing this insane impact of these Americanized conspiracies within Canada. And it's very fascinating. It's very scary. And I think it's something worth being covered.
So you've covered a lot of these fringe groups that that act in pretty unpredictable ways. My own experience with men rights activists slandering me as a Holocaust denier taught me that, if anything. What costs have you paid for your work?
Oh, it's gotten to the point where there's a couple things I actually can't bring up publicly.
Why is that?
Lawyers are involved. So it's gotten to that point. If you ever want to buy me a beer, any of you out there, if you buy Mac a beer, I'll probably tell you, but I'm just not going to say it publicly on a podcast.
Well, what can you tell us? Like, what are some of the things, you don't have to say who specifically, but what are some of the things that have been said about you?
Yeah, I've been slandered as a pedophile. I've been called every name in the book.
When you say called, are these just people just tweeting at you? I mean, I get tweeted at.
I've gotten, my mom's gotten letters. They've sent my mom letters because that's the only address they're able to find of me.
Letters at?
Hate mail. Old school hate mail.
Okay.
You know, I've gotten lots of like Twitter DMs, lots of emails. They somehow found my first ever email, which is insane. I didn't think anybody would ever find my Hotmail email. I think one of the scariest things that happened to me was back when I was starting out, and it was actually not even the far-right extremists that did this. It was the men's rights activists who have slandered you as well, where they just sent me my address. It was nothing more. It was an egg Twitter account that just sent me my address. And
So you got doxed?
Yeah, I got doxed. I've been doxed a couple times. Never majorly, but I've had things that people have made, I'm trying to think of the best way I can put this. They've mocked up fake news articles, say of Global and say of Metro, where they've said things about me and it's gotten back to my family, where my family had to be like, explain this to me. And
really?
Yeah.
And allegations about you.
Yes. Which aren't true. But like that happens. And
they send them to your family or they spread them online?
Spread them online. And in the end, it gets back. I don't know if it's explicitly being sent to my family, but
I assume this is where the lawyers are involved.
No comment. One of the more interesting things is that I have one of the Frenchest last names in the world. It has an X in it and like 17 vowels, and they call me a Jew, which is very, like, it's gotten to the point, like, I was speaking to the lead investigator of the Southern Poverty Law Center. They say, like, she is one of the most thoroughly German people I've ever talked to, and they call her a Jew. Like, it's gotten to the point where, like, if in any way you report any sort of things that people look at as left of center, they will call you a Jew.
It's still the far right's go-to.
Yeah. Like, have you ever been called a Jew? Omar Mulawam?
No, I can't. Actually, I can't say I've gotten that one.
We can all strive.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
It is scary. And yet you do investigate them. You have... Mm-hmm. For lack of a better term, infiltrated these groups,
true, yeah.
These extremist political groups. They operate through intimidation of immigrants and religious mm-hmm. minorities, also of the media and lefties or liberals.
Yeah.
Soldiers of Odin, for example. I mean, I tried to interview the Edmonton chapter's leader for an article last year. And they wouldn't trust me.
Was this William Crotty?
Yeah, it was William Crotty. And I think it was whoever operates their main account. And they said, before we agree to an interview, we would like you to explain Sharia law to us and whether you believe it is dangerous, something along those lines. And I foolishly did. I foolishly tried to explain to them my feelings about Sharia law and how it's basically...
To be fair, that's how I start every one of our conversations.
Yes, that is true. That is true. That's how we started our conversation in the studio today. But, I mean, you know, guess what? They still wouldn't talk to me even...
You're saying an anti-Islam group wouldn't talk to somebody named Omar Mulawam?
Yeah, who knows?
Oh, wow.
Who would have thought? So how do you do it? I mean, how do you investigate them and get them to talk to you?
So I guess the two biggest stories I've kind of broken among the way, a lot of smaller stories, but the two biggest ones I've broken was I was able to be the first reporter in Canada to write about both the Soldiers of Odin, which was back in 2015 or very, very early 2016, and the Three Percenters, which was this summer. And I took two very different approaches at how I did these stories. With the Soldiers of Odin, they wouldn't let me in as a journalist, so I made a... Oh, there's going to be a few journalist ethics t-shirts that are just going to be shaking after I explain how I got into this. So essentially, I made a fake Facebook page under the name, I believe, Mark Machansky. Apologies to all Mark Machanskys out there.
So you didn't go with an Arab name like
I didn't go with Omar Mulawam.
Okay, so that was my first mistake.
That's a big yep. They're not that big of fans. And I made it explicitly racist. I had Screwdriver, which is Ian Donaldson's band. He's the one who coined Blood and Honor, one of the biggest white supremacist bands of all time, I believe. And then I put that as the cover photo, and I believe as my Facebook picture, I put a couple pictures of Lucky Lager for a little bit of Alberta pride there.
So the first time you tried to join these groups as Mac Lamoureux.
Yep. They didn't let me in.
Wouldn't let you in. You make this new profile, and then what happens?
So essentially, I make this profile, and within an hour, I'm within their secret group. They have invited me to see their organizing page, and within 2 hours, they invited me to a meeting at a Radian Hotel in West Edmonton in a couple of days.
And did you go?
I did go. So I went with my one sports reporter friend who had no idea what he was getting into. I won't say his name because I don't think he really wants to be associated with this style of my reporting. So we went and we got recruited. We got initiated into the Soldiers of Odin, and it got a little hairy at times.
What were they? What did they want to discuss? Because they, from your article, it was they were more interested actually in the optics of their group, so that down the line, mm-hmm. when they believe the Muslim invasion comes, across the pond to North America, not that it's necessarily come to Europe.
Yeah.
They want to look good. Tell me about that.
So a lot of it was focused on doing good things like the community, like cleaning up needles and doing this. But that was mainly for the optics. When they were speaking, I remember clearly, I believe it was the leader. If it wasn't the leader, it was one of the sergeant at arms said that we need to look as good as we can, because when the shit hits the fan, which is a prepper term, which means that essentially when Armageddon comes or when a moment happened, and they were referring to the Islamic
Islamic invasion of Canada. So when the shit hits the fan, like when the race war happens, we need to be able to look good and have people on our side.
So at some point they ask you for your IDs. What do you do?
Yeah, so essentially we were all standing around a pool table while we were going over what the being sorted of Odin is like. And we've gone over pretty much everything. And they then say, of course, you can't be under a certain age. I think it was 25. It was 25. And they looked at me and they looked at my friend and they said, you guys look pretty young. Show us your IDs. And us being flustered, I remember we were both like, we left it in the truck.
It's a weird thing to do at a bar, leave your ID in the truck.
Especially after you have bought beer with your wallet in front of them. And so they didn't really believe us, but I remember one of the bigger guys, because when you picture the Soldiers of Odin, just picture like a lot of men that look like people who couldn't get into the Hell's Angels, but they're pretty big dudes. And he was like, okay, well, I'll follow you to your car then. We're like, this will be fun. And so I remember, because I'm a smoker and everyone in the Soldiers of Odin is a smoker, I was like, let's go do a dart, boys. And they're like, yeah, let's all go have a cigarette. And they all left and we're like, we're going to pay up, which again is a very weird thing to say when you've left your wallet in a truck. And we left through the kitchen of the Radian and then circled around the entirety of the hotel because I wasn't too worried about what the soldiers were going to do to us. At the very worst, they were just going to beat us up. There was one man who I would probably describe as a tweaker. He was either coming off drugs or he was coming on, like he was very high at the moment. And I was really worried that he was going to try and prove himself to the group by doing something irrational, by doing something impulsive if he found out we were there under false pretenses as an investigative role. And so that was my major worry. And I knew several of these guys, they had knives on them. Some of them did have some weapons on them.
So what happened later when you approached them as the journalist that you are to get their take, to get their response?
They were not happy with me. They gave me a statement. But then I remember them saying, well, Mac Lamoureux ruined it for everybody because we have open doors, but we're not going to do it anymore. No, they don't. They weren't letting any journalist in. No one knew how these guys were operating. It was a last ditch resort. I don't do stuff like that lightly. And even now, I still do stories. I did a story about how the Soldiers of Odin in Red Deer were essentially shaking down homeless people while they were looking for indigenous suspects. That was just a few months ago I did that story. Got a little bit of a scoop there. And I reached out to the spokesman and they were like, no, long time, no talk, Mac. So they still remember me. That's good and bad.
So you had another approach with the three percenters, which you spent 8 months investigating.
8 months investigating.
Tell me how you did things differently there.
So essentially, I was very open about being a journalist with the three percenters. I didn't outwardly scream I was a journalist, but
wait, from the get-go you were?
Yeah, so it was when I got into their secret pages, it was all my public account. They're just apparently bad at OPSEC. So essentially what happened is that back when Trudeau was elected in 2015, the reason I was able to get these stories is I thought we were going to see something that happened in 2008 with Obama. There was going to be a resurgence of all of these militia groups. And so what I did is I just took my personal Facebook page and I joined it to some of the most vitriently racist groups I could find within Canada to see if they were going to start recruiting. And I was able to get into this 3% group, which just started as an anti-Trudeau group for a long time. And then something clicked and they started organizing and they started shooting and they started doing drills where they were assaulting cars. And I just started keeping a really good focus on there.
Assaulting cars? Not the public's cars.
No. So they would drive a car somewhere and they would do assault drills on, say you need to take someone down from within a car. What do you do? How do you flank the car? That sort of thing.
How strange is this for Canada?
Immensely. It's very immensely strange. We have seen a few kind of militia style groups, mostly in Quebec, which is where you would kind of expect to see them. But not so much in Anglophone Canada, not so much in Western Canada. It's extremely weird, and it's extremely weird to see them use this American style of training. Dr. Barbara Perry, who is with Ryan Scrivens, Canada's foremost leader in right-wing extremism, told me when I first brought this up to her, I was speaking about her it for months when I was reporting on this, that it scared her. This actually scared her, and she's never seen this before. So essentially, I got into this group, and what I did is I just watched this group move and train, and over time I was able to get into different things because they thought I was a member. And again, I was very openly a journalist in this case.
Not in that you were asking questions as they went along, though. I mean, you, it seems like you sat back quietly and you watched for quite a while.
It happen.
Weren't you afraid of losing the scoop, or weren't you afraid of this thing escalating into violence and getting there because, you know, you hadn't reported on it yet, or because you were waiting for, you know, some switch to go off?
That's why we reported on it, is because it got to the point where we couldn't sit on it anymore. And what the big thing was for me is that I saw that they were sitting outside of mosques.
Wow.
And to me, yeah, and that was actually something
that's what they claimed to be doing.
That was something that when I did sit down with the leader, and I did do a big, long, several-hour interview with the leader of the 3%ers, he confirmed that to me, that they were doing that.
In Calgary,
yeah. I was never able to track down exactly what mosque they were doing. I knew they did it to at least three, and I don't know if they're still currently doing it, but...
Why these mosques? There's lots of mosques in Calgary. There's lots of mosques in Alberta.
So essentially, Alberta hasn't had the greatest track record. We have had people go over and that were radicalized within our province, and several of these mosques were tied to that radicalization. There was one that was one of the worst in Canada for radicalization. I'm not saying there was a lot of people that went through. I'm just saying in terms of all the mosques in Canada, it was one of the more notorious ones.
Notorious as in that radicalized people were congregants of this mosque?
Disenfranchised youth would go to this mosque and they would end up going to Syria.
I see.
Yeah. And so they would sit outside there. And there was some mosques that weren't like that. There was just some mosques that were just there for them. And they would go, and they, I remember one time Bo told me that they saw, they were loading crates in at 4 a.m. And he was like, doesn't that seem suspicious to you? They're moving arms, they're moving ammunition, they're moving guns. I'm like, no, that's just a time people who get up early move things sometimes because it's easier to get around.
Also, like, you know, there's Fajr, the like 4 or 5 a.m. prayer. So, you know, could have been people just making their early arrival to mosque for prayer.
Yeah. I'm going to act like I knew about that.
I'm just being pedantic.
And so essentially, when I saw that they were doing this, it was, we had it out within a week. We just felt we couldn't sit on it, too long. And, but when it comes to a story like this, of course I don't want to be scooped, but it was, and I don't want to sound like an altruistic person or anything. Well, I am altruistic, but I don't want to sound like some sort of journalistic ideologue. But I wouldn't have minded that this story got out. I just wanted as much information to be able to do the story that I did do, which is why we sat on it. But when they did go a bridge too far, we pulled the trigger.
Does your upbringing in rural Alberta, your own experience living, you know, the roughneck life, I have to imagine that it helps you, I think you said this earlier, it helps you relate to them.
Yeah.
Does it help you understand the red-blooded Albertan who might be persuaded by these kinds of groups and beliefs?
Totally. It totally does. I was definitely somebody raised on Alberta first, not America first, but just that, like, we're Albertans above Canadians, where this is our heritage. My family actually has a long heritage within Canada. We were the first French-Canadian family to settle Alberta.
Uh-huh.
And definitely.
Well, and you mentioned militia groups in Quebec and that you wouldn't expect to see this in Western Alberta, but actually Alberta has a bit of an individualist streak.
Yeah, we have a huge individualistic streak.
There's still somewhat of a secessionist.
Yeah, and just the way I act, I believe you've described me before as a rural Alberta dirtbag, which I very proudly am.
And I still describe you that way to everyone I talk to about you.
But I'm able to... at least when I'm speaking to them, really relate to them, really speak their language. They asked me to join the militia, which was extremely weird for me. And I obviously said no. I feel that just the way that I'm able to act, at least in terms of these hyper-localized Alberta groups, I'm able to relate to them more. But also, I don't want to say I get where the anger is coming from. I get the anger towards minorities or anything. I don't want to say that I get it at all, but I understand that times are tough. There's a lot of disenfranchisement that's happening. And whenever you see times of political and economic strife, you are going to see reactionary groups jump up. And I have had friends from my hometown who have overdosed on fentanyl and died of the opioid crisis. I've had friends that lose jobs, that they're struggling really hard. And I understand when a group like this comes in and they say, you know what, this isn't your fault. This is the fault of the government, and this is the fault of the immigrants that are coming in, and we are giving them $90,000 a year, whatever the modern day conspiracy is right now, of the riches we're giving the immigrants who come in here and the refugees that are coming in here. I get that when times are really tough, that might be a very, you could grab that and it could give you hope. Your life being a little in shatters isn't your fault. And in a lot of these groups, there is a very big aspect of community. There's a very big aspect of brotherhood. They help each other out. They raise money for each other. And I see why that can be intoxicating to some people. So I don't want to say that I get it, but I get it, if that makes any sense.
You know, we rarely, for a media show, we rarely talk to media professionals about how they got started in this business. Yeah. But I want to talk to you about your start, because even though you're still in your 20s, this is actually your second career. Why did you leave the lucrative oil fields for, you know, journalism's paltry paydays?
I got away with words, but so essentially, I was working in the oil fields when I was a young man. I started working kind of in the trades when I was around 16 in high school. It's what you do when you're from my town. It's you get a job in the trades. You go to NATE. You get a house. You get a
NATE is the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology.
Yeah, the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology.
It's a trade school.
Yeah, it's one of the best in Canada. And go Edmonton. And so essentially, you get a truck. You get a house. You have 2.5 kids, and you never really move all that far away from your family. But I always found it a little grating to just go and pull the same wrench every day. I have immense respect for people in the trades. But then when I was 21, close to 22, I had my best friend, Graham Gobert. He passed away in a car accident. And I just realized I didn't really want to, at the time before he passed away, we were both speaking about maybe leaving Fort Saskatchewan, which is a big conversation to have at that age. And I didn't go to pieces, but the minute that he passed away, my connection to my hometown and my connection to the trade started eroding, and I quit my pretty well-paying job driving locomotives at a liquid propane gas plant of all places and applied for Grant MacEwan University in Edmonton, Alberta for a journalism program because I wanted to be a writer, but my fiction sucks. So I decided journalism was the way to go, and then I did it, and I wouldn't have done it any other way. I was happy to bring the blue-collar kind of trades work ethic with me because I was able to make a go as a full-time freelancer while I was still in school.
Yeah, I mean, your career came together pretty fast.
Yeah.
I met you while you were a student, and that wasn't that long ago. That was 2 years ago. You're kind of a glimmer of hope because I think a lot of journalism students are afraid that there's just not any more jobs left for them. And they're not right. They are scarce.
It's difficult. Very difficult.
So what's your advice? Like, what's your inspiration for the emerging journalists listening to this?
Well, media is in a very bad place right now. It's also changing. It sure looks like post-media is going to die and there might not be jobs in papers, or at least good jobs. You're not going to have the jobs that you go and join a paper and you're there till the end of time anymore. But there are outlets that are starting. You have Canada Land where you can freelance. I know a man named Graham Gordon who got a start freelancing for Canada Land. I started writing for Vice. There's people that are making livings writing for BuzzFeed. There's The Baffler. There's The Outline. There's all of these online kind of alternative media outlets. There's also CBC is great, but it's incredibly hard and you have to hustle. And no, there's going to be maybe two people out of your graduating class that in 10 years will be doing this. Make damn sure it's you. Like, you don't have to be ruthless. You don't have to slit throats, but you have to outwork everyone. If you become a reliable person who can develop a beat, any sort of beat, you will get work. And one of the beauties with like the changing media landscape, which while it can be very scary, it can be very I know how insane it is to look out from being a freelancer and look out and have no idea what you're going to do. But you're able to take where you are and write for anyone in the world now. I've seen stories about Edmonton on Al Jazeera. I got my first break by being the first person in Edmonton to write for Vice and write a bunch of stories, say, about the push-up guy. If you're not from Edmonton, you're not going to know that. It's just, you're going to have to go with this.
You've actually taken a lot of things that I took for granted as an Albertan, like the push-up guy and the fact that we throw coins at strippers in this province, and actually done deep dives into them and shine a light on them in a way that I don't think people ever understood. And thank you for that. Thanks for putting Alberta's idiosyncrasies on Alberta the international first, radar. But I'm sorry that you left our province for Big Bad Ontario.
Me too.
Such a fancy pants now in Toronto.
I miss the hell out of Edmonton.
I hope for the day that you move back. Mac Lamoureux, thanks so much for joining us on Canada Land.
Thank you, Omar.
That's your Canada Land show. You can email me at omar@canadalandshow.com. We are on Twitter at Canada Land, and I'm at omar_AOK. Find Canada Land on Facebook to get our stories in your news feed when we publish them. You could also go to our website at canadalandshow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/canadaland. This show was produced by Kevin Sexton and Ali Graham. We have recorded this in Edmonton with Scott Franchuk at Riverdale Recorders. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, please support us on Patreon.